From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We recorded 20 and a half inches of snow on Staten Island, 19 inches in lower Manhattan, 18 and a half inches in Washington Heights, 16 inches in northern Brooklyn, 18 and a half inches in Woodside, and 15 inches in the Bronx. In other words, a lot of snow every place.
And that's just New York. The East Coast is struggling to recover from the massive blizzard that slammed into hundreds of cities and towns from the Carolinas to Maine. The storm was a grimly fitting end to 2010. Extreme weather from start to finish, with heat waves, floods, volcanoes, super typhoons, blizzards, landslides, and droughts. While TV networks blare the words extreme weather, what about another two words, global warming? We'll speak with Dr. Paul Epstein of Harvard University's Center for Health and the Global Environment. Then renowned physician and human rights activist Dr. Binayak Sen has been sentenced to life in prison in India. We'll speak with his wife and play an interview with him speaking about his own case. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newly disclosed records show violence has increased in key areas across Afghanistan this year. According to the Wall Street Journal, confidential UN maps list a worsened security climate in 16 Afghan districts in the north and east between March and October. The situation remains dire in the south, where most of the fighting between the U.S.-led NATO forces and militants has taken place. Just two districts that were deemed high risk in March were later given an improved rating. The Afghan government, meanwhile, is condemning a U.S.-led NATO raid that killed two people in the capital of Kabul on Saturday. U.S. officials say NATO forces targeted a building based on credible intelligence of militant activity. But the Afghan government says two security guards were killed without provocation after foreign troops surrounded their compound. Afghan presidential spokesperson Waheed Omar criticized the attack.
This was an irresponsible way of dealing with an issue within the Kabul city. And that was clearly conveyed, and that was discussed yesterday between us, our security council, and the commander of NATO and other colleagues from international community yesterday.
Incumbent Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo remains under international pressure to leave office after refusing to concede disputed elections last month. A delegation of heads of state from Benin, Sierra Leone and Cape Verde is traveling to the Ivory Coast today to deliver an ultimatum for Gbagbo to leave office or face removal by force. Opposition leader Alassane Ouattara has been widely recognized as the winner of the election, but Gbagbo claims the vote was rigged. Gbagbo's security forces have been accused of orchestrating some 200 deaths, hundreds of arrests, dozens of cases of disappearances and torture in recent weeks. Gbagbo has hired prominent lobbyist Lani Davis to represent him in Washington, a former White House special counsel under President Clinton. Davis's recent clients include Ecuadorian Guinean dictator Teodoro Obiang, as well as key supporters of the 2009 coup in Honduras. In a recent interview with CNN, Davis was questioned about his pledge to drop Gbagbo as a client if there's credible proof of human rights abuses under Gbagbo's watch.
Have you read the UN findings that they have substantiated that arbitrary arrests have been committed, torture, dozens of cases of torture, ill treatment, and enforced disappearances of people over the past 1 week? Does that not constitute proof? I'm just asking if you believe in that.
Does it constitute proof for you when you read a UN report?
No, I'm asking you if it constitutes proof for
you.
What more would you need in order to be convinced that?
I'm not sure who's doing the interviewing. I would take very seriously that UN report. I've read it. I'd like to see the substantiation. I'd like to see who wrote it. I know that there have been UN reports concerning Israel that have been completely discredited as biased. I'd like to know who's writing the report. And I certainly take it very seriously if that report is true. Of course, I could not defend atrocities and human rights abuses.
You can go to our website at democracynow.org for coverage of the Ivory Coast from Monday's broadcast. You can also go to our website to see our interview with Lonnie Davis when he was representing those who supported the coup in Honduras. In Iraq, at least 19 people were killed and 45 wounded in a pair of suicide bombings Monday in the western city of Ramadi. The attack struck a government compound where relatives of state workers killed in a previous bombing had gathered to receive compensation. In other Iraq news, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is vowing the Iraqi government won't extend a deadline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops in 2011. In his first interview since negotiating an end to Iraq's long-term parliamentary gridlock, Maliki told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "This agreement is not subject to extension, not subject to alteration. It is sealed." Maliki added the timetable could be changed if Iraq and the U.S. reach a new status of forces agreement, which would require parliamentary approval. Palestinians in the occupied territories have begun marking the second anniversary of the U.S.-backed three-week Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip. Dubbed Operation Cast Lead by the Israeli military, the attack left over 1,400 Palestinians dead and many more wounded. On Monday, a group of children took part in a march through Gaza. The director of a children's charity, Munir Barakat, said the assault has left psychological damage.
The anniversary of the cruel aggression will not ease in the children's memories and their playtime. And their everyday lives, it occupies their minds every minute.
Meanwhile, in Israel, the prominent peace activist Jonathan Pollack has been sentenced to 3 months in prison for taking part in a bicycle rally against the Israeli blockade on Gaza 3 years ago. Pollack, founder of the group Anarchists Against the Wall, which works with Palestinians to hold frequent protests in the West Bank. Pollack was convicted for taking part in a critical mass bike ride through Tel Aviv. Supporters say Pollack is being targeted for his political involvement. You can also go to democracynow.org to see our interview with Jonathan Pollack. Former Arkansas governor and Republican presidential hopeful Mike Huckabee is under scrutiny over ties to a firm alleged to have defrauded vulnerable homeowners in foreclosure. Huckabee has appeared in commercials advertising a petition to recall President Obama's signature health care law. The petition, called Repeal It Now, is sponsored by the political action group Restore America's Voice, or RAV. According to the website Think Progress, Rav's campaign is run by a firm called the 949 Group. 949's owner, Derek Oberholzer, runs several companies, including a firm that claims to offer distressed homeowners assistance in modifying loans or halting foreclosures. But according to Consumer Reports, a Federal Trade Commission suit and a complaint from the Idaho Attorney General, Oberholzer's company billed numerous customers up to $1,000 without ever taking action on their cases. A new analysis shows nearly 100 bailed-out U.S. banks are in danger of collapse despite an infusion of taxpayer aid. The Wall Street Journal reports 98 banks are at risk of failing even after receiving a total of $4.2 billion in government cash. Seven bailed-out banks have already collapsed at a cost of $2.7 billion. And a new analysis shows nearly 100 bailed-out U.S. banks are in danger of collapse despite an infusion of taxpayer aid. The Wall Street Journal reports 98 banks are at risk of failing even after receiving a total of $4.2 billion in government cash. And according to the Washington Post, the Obama administration's begun monitoring the board meetings of nearly 20 banks that have repeatedly failed to pay back sums under the terms of their taxpayer rescue. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. While much of the East Coast is still struggling to recover from the massive blizzard that slammed into hundreds of cities and towns from the Carolinas to Maine the day after Christmas, six states—Massachusetts, Maine, Maryland, New Jersey, North Carolina and Virginia—declared states of emergency. The storm buried cities in more than 2 feet of snow and unleashed winds of up to 80 miles per hour. Thousands of passengers have been stranded during the busy holiday season, with thousands of flights as well as train and bus routes canceled. It was a grimly fitting end to 2010, which was characterized by extreme weather from start to finish, with earthquakes, heat waves, floods, volcanoes, super typhoons, blizzards, landslides, and droughts. in Pakistan. Massive flooding submerged one-fifth of the country underwater. In Russia, a record heat wave sparked wildfires that left 15,000 people dead. In Niger, first a severe drought threatened widespread famine, then floods left more than 100,000 people homeless. In Europe, heavy snow and blizzards threw air traffic into turmoil. Deadly floods and mudslides killed thousands in China, India, Venezuela, Indonesia, and many other countries. Meanwhile, preliminary data show that 18 countries broke their records for the hottest day ever. In fact, 2010 may go down as the hottest on record worldwide, this according to the World Meteorological Organization. While TV networks blare the two words extreme weather, what about another two? Global warming. Dr. Paul Epstein is Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He's co-author of the forthcoming book, Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. He's joining us via Democracy Now! Video stream from his home in Brookline, Massachusetts. Dr. Epstein, welcome to Democracy Now! Let's get an assessment from you. One article said, bundle up. It's global warming. Relate the two, the freezing weather, to global warming.
Good. Well, good morning, Amy. Good to be with you. Yes, we are certainly in a spate of extreme weather events, and it seems that this year has been a real uptick in all sorts of events, from heavy rains to droughts to heat waves and now cold weather. And I think if we think back at last winter, we also had a very intense winter with three large snowstorms together. And now we're seeing this heavy heavy snowfall in the United States, but also the last several months in Europe, as you recall here. The underlying issue between global warming and climate change, meaning warming and changes in weather patterns, is that in the last 50 years, the oceans have absorbed 22 times as much heat as has the atmosphere. I'm going to repeat that because it's not often considered as part of the global warming story, but the heat of the last half century has built up in the oceans, and it's the accelerated evaporation off of warm oceans that drives the heavy rains. A warmer atmosphere also holds more water vapor. For each 1 degree centigrade it heats up, it holds 7% more water vapor. So there's a push and a pull on the whole water cycle. And the key here is that global warming in the atmosphere through the ocean engine is now changing the weather patterns, and it's the hydrological cycle, the Earth's water cycle, that's been dramatically changed, with more droughts in some areas and more intense rains in others, and now intense snows.
We are getting tremendous wall-to-wall, 24-hour-a-day coverage of weather. In fact, we got an email from a friend. The subject said, news, with a question mark. And then it said, questioning why we were covering weather, saying, what's next, traffic and sports? But the weather is news. If the newscasters on television took it on by talking about the issue of global warming, you know, what people can do about this. I want to go to the issue of how it's covered in the media. Dr. Paul Epstein, start off by talking about this issue. A study from George Mason University conducted in March reports that just 54% of U.S. weathercasters accept that climate change is happening, and that fewer than a third believe that climate change was caused mostly by human activities. TV forecasters aren't required to have any formal training in climate change to receive certification by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. One weather forecaster who appears regularly on many news outlets and has been quoted in the mainstream press is AccuWeather's expert senior meteorologist, Joe Bastardi. He's regularly questioned the science of global warming. This is a clip of Joe Bastardi from last week on the Fox Business Network.
Well, look, I want to show you something. It's something you good folks at Fox allowed me to put on because you're fair and balanced a few years ago about what, why we have to start looking for more and more. This is called the Triple Crown of Cooling, the natural reversal of the ocean cycles. 3 years ago, the Pacific went from its warm state into its cold state. Solar activity, very low sunspot activity, and volcanic activity, not the kind you see in the tropics, but the kind we had up in the Arctic regions a couple of winters ago. And this is something that we opine could be causing a return to, for instance, the times of the Victorian era in Europe, where they used to have ice fairs around in the early 1800s, around Christmas time on the Thames. And you're seeing that type of thing go on.
Are you saying that we are in a period of global cooling?
Well, I've been saying that what I believe is going on is that this is a big debate between the natural cycles and the forces of the, from AGW. By the way, these folks that are now claiming that global warming is causing all the severe cold, that's like the kid on the playground that doesn't get his way and takes his ball home. The fact of the matter is that the forecast was made by this forecaster 3 years ago that we're going to start seeing these things because of this, and it opens up the big debate. Are the natural cycles taking over, and are we going to see cooling over the next 20 to 30 years? What I'm saying to you, Brian, is this is predictable if you study cycles, study climatology, then throw the computer in and don't just say, well, everything's global warming.
That was AccuWeather's expert, senior meteorologist Joe Bastardi. Dr. Paul Epstein, your response.
Sure. Well, just and that was an interesting tape and an interesting analysis, because he's trying to get at the dynamics that are driving the current weather. So before we get to the media, just for a moment, it's important that we do try to analyze what are the dynamics behind the current weather we're seeing. And in fact, in the North Atlantic, we've seen so much ice melt off of Greenland and in the Arctic Sea that it creates a cold sheen across the ocean, the North Atlantic, and that sets up a high pressure system. Hot air rises, creating lows, and cold air sinks, creating highs. And it's that North Atlantic high that's actually persisted for the last 15 months, one of the longest periods on record, due to the ice melt, we can presume, that is driving these high winds, cold weather, shooting across Europe down to the low pressure system that's over Middle East because they've had so much heat. So in fact, it is essential to think about what are the changes in the ocean and in the ice cover. Those are they're playing leading roles that are driving today's weather patterns. What we see, we used to say no one event is diagnostic of global warming. In fact, climate is changing. Climate has changed, meaning weather patterns have changed. And so everything we're seeing is due to natural variability and climate change. It's a function of both of those interacting. And we can no longer just pass this off and say, is this event global warming? Is that we are in the midst of climate change, and it affects all of our weather patterns, again, primarily through the oceans and ice cover. Now, the media has done a real up and down job on this whole issue, but the connection between warming and warming of the oceans and the extreme weather events that have become much more common is something that the media has been spotty, slow to pick up, and one wonders where the agenda for that kind of ignoring a pattern that's emerging and something in the scientific literature that's now well accepted. Even up to a year and a half ago, this was not so. There were many questions in the scientific literature about the connections, and now it's well accepted, and all of the modeling studies show that we're going to see more extreme weather events and more intense outliers. But it's not just the models, it's the data and the first principles. Those are the three parts of science: the models, the data, the first principles. And the first principles are that greenhouse gases trap heat in the atmosphere. The data shows us the oceans are warming, and the data is now very clear that we're seeing heavier rain events and more droughts. Over the U.S., for example, since 1970, rains have gone up a little bit, like 7%. But the 2 inches of day, 2 inches a day rains have gone up 14%. 4 inches a day rains have gone up 20%. And 6 inches a day rains have gone up 27%. A whole shift in the whole pattern of extreme events, the bell-shaped curve, if you picture the normal distribution of events from warm to cold to dry to hot, the whole curve is changing shape as the Earth gets warmer. And we're seeing more extremes of both ends, hotter days as well as colder periods, more rain in some areas, more drought in others. And it's a whole pattern where the curve is kind of caving in on itself, fewer normal days, and much more in the extremes. This is what we call now climate instability. Climate instability meaning that rates of change in the ice are accelerating, wider swings from one extreme to the other, more chance of major outliers like the heat wave in Russia, the floods in Pakistan, these storms now. This is all part of a changing climate, and global warming is the word that the two words that kind of throw us. The real issue is climate change, climate instability, and unfortunately, it appears that this is all accelerating, particularly over this last year.
You asked about agendas, Dr. Paul Epstein. Well, Fox News is under scrutiny over newly disclosed directives to its reporters. The group Media Matters released a leaked memo showing a top Fox News editor ordering journalists to always state that climate change data has been called into question when discussing the topic. The directive originated during the Copenhagen climate talks last year, when a Fox News correspondent correctly reported UN data that the last decade was the warmest on record. Minutes later, Fox News Washington managing editor Bill Salmon sent out a memo questioning, quote, the veracity of climate change data, and ordering correspondents to, quote, refrain from asserting that the planet has warmed or cooled in any given period without immediately pointing out that such theories are based upon data that critics have called into question, unquote. Dr. Paul Epstein.
Well, manufacturing doubt is what this is called, and there's been a well-orchestrated, well-funded campaign to keep up this drumbeat of doubt about climate change. It's affected the media, it's affected the politicians, it's affected some in the public. What's interesting is it hasn't affected much of the business community, that particularly the insurance world, that's well aware of the risks of climate change and the risks to their business of the extreme weather events. So as we see this corporate agenda work its way through the media, it's becoming a smaller group of corporations, really the fossil fuel industries, that keep manufacturing this drumbeat of doubt. And that's all you have to do to keep the discussion off track is to say that there is doubt. It's, in fact, the consensus of the scientific community throughout the world, the academy, the national academies of all these nations that met in Cancun recently, is well aware that their climate is changing, that the explanation for it is found in the greenhouse gas effect of fossil fuel burning, and 80% of the greenhouse problem is burning fossil fuels, 20% is felling forests. And it's this pattern of warming and long-term warming of the oceans that really is already affecting our health, affecting our forests, our crops, and it's begun to affect the global economy. Look at what's happening now with these storms, tremendous power outages in addition to injuries and deaths in some areas, particularly in Europe. and business interruptions that are insured and many uninsured. And this is really the danger that we're going to see the instability affect our health, our society, and business community. And I think we're seeing it come on even faster than we predicted. We've underestimated the rate at which climate would change, just as we've underestimated some of the biological impacts, like ticks that carry Lyme disease now up into the north of Maine and so on. And
well, I want to talk about that for a minute. Dr. Paul Epstein, it's also the subject of your forthcoming book. It is the issue of people's health. I'm not just talking about people getting colds when it's super cold out. By the way, in New York, you know, it's been extremely cold, and now New Year's Eve is expected to rise up to perhaps 50 degrees this weekend. It's astounding, the shifts in temperature. But this issue of how global climate affects people's health, going, for example, to the issue of insect migration.
Yes. Well, and as you point out, it's the 50 degrees we're looking at. It's this instability and variability and volatility that when it appears on the stock markets, we get worried that there's going to be dramatic change. And it's also what's going on with weather patterns. Five areas in which climate affects health. Infectious disease is one, respiratory disease and asthma particularly. Third is now these winter weather anomalies that we're seeing more of, heat waves and its impacts, and then the impacts of pests and pathogens, diseases on crops, forests, and marine life that are also responding to warming and to the extremes. Now, if we look at the infectious disease for a moment, here, as I mentioned, we've seen Lyme disease carried by ticks, an arachnoid, in the spider family, go tenfold in Maine this decade and move up to the northern latitudes. Now, if we look at the United States and overall, it's warmed about 1 degree Fahrenheit in the last 100 years. Maine has warmed 2 degrees, but the winters have gone up 3 degrees. In Alaska, the temperature is even more dramatic. We've seen increase in overall temperatures 3.4 degrees, and winters have warmed a startling 6.4 degrees. So Alaska's experiencing mosquitoes, stinging insects, and then these forest beetles that are from Arizona all the way up to Alaska, decimating forests, and they are overwintering, moving to higher latitudes, moving to higher altitudes, sneaking in more generations each year. And the droughts dry the trees, dry the rosin that normally drowns the beetles as they try to drive through the bark. So the extremes weaken the trees, the temperatures and warming and lack of killing frosts embolden the pests, and we're seeing this dramatic increase. But that's not the whole story with infectious disease. It's also these floods and droughts. It's the extreme weather events that affect the timing, the intensity, the location of outbreaks. After floods, we see upsurges of malaria in many countries, just as we're seeing floods set off cholera in Haiti, combined with the impacts of the earthquake, of course. And in droughts, we often see diseases like dengue fever, where people store water about their houses, and the Aedes aegypti that carries that disease surges. So it's the extremes as well as the warming that affect infectious disease. In this country, we've mapped it out. Over 2 inches a day rains are associated with waterborne disease outbreaks from E. coli, Cryptosporidium. So again, it's not just the warming, it's the extreme weather events that affect either timing, intensity of infectious disease outbreaks.
That was one of your 5 points. Number two?
Number two, asthma. We've seen a tremendous rise in pollen counts. And one of the explanations appears to be the rise in carbon dioxide only. Rise in carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels and felling forests affects ragweed pollen. And we've taken back of Harvard in the greenhouses, we've put ragweed under double CO2 in containers, and the pollen goes up 60%. The stalks only go up about 10%. We're seeing tremendous counts in the fall. We're seeing early arrival of spring and spring, these some of the fast-growing trees. So the whole allergy and asthma season has prolonged about 2 to 3 weeks in the Northern Hemisphere, depending on location. More pollen, diesel particles and other particles from burning fossil fuels, coal and diesel, helps deliver these pollen grains deep into the lungs. If they glob on to one another, and then ozone from burning fossil fuels and combined with others also affects our lungs. So here we are, burning fossil fuels and carbon dioxide, burning fossil fuels and diesel, burning fossil fuels and ozone, and then the aggregate, the prolongation of the spring and spring to fall season affecting the whole amount of exposure that we are having to pollen in the spring and fall. And we've seen a doubling to tripling of asthma in this country in the last 2 to 3 decades. So some of this may be accountable by climate change and the burning of fossil fuels. Heat waves, number three, clearly related to warming. And here, again, what you've recounted in Russia, we're seeing more of these major events, major outliers. If we think back in 2003 in Europe, this was an event, a summer heat wave. There was 6 standard deviations from the norm. In other words, back to our bell-shaped curve, way out there in the tails. Not 1 or 2 standard deviations, but way out with with heating that was not recorded not in any of our records back to 1890s when we've started our good global records. Winter weather we've addressed, and here we are again with the oceans and the ice cover affecting that. And then finally, what keeps me up at night are the bark beetles and some of the other pests that are affecting forests. And here we have very little in public health to offer to stop the longhorn beetles that are affecting the eastern coast. They're an invasive species, but warming affects the range in which they can occur. Now, these cold winters are going to knock it back. Cold winters are excellent for public health. So that may actually set back some of the pests that are affecting the forest. But in general, over the last several decades, we've seen an aphid-like bug, for instance, affect the hemlock trees. Not the hemlock you take to solve all your problems, but pine tree hemlocks affected by the woolly adelgid. And it's moved through Connecticut, through Massachusetts, threatening Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine. And again, it's the warm winters that have allowed the overwintering and the increase in generations of these pests of forests that then change our forest cover, which affects streams, it affects our oxygen, the carbon storage ability. So these are the long-term issues in terms of the life support systems and how they'll respond to climate change.
Dr. Paul Epstein, in just the minute we have left, sure, what people can do about it?
We can do a lot. We need to move as we are towards electric vehicles and stop burning everything. Even ethanol has its health impacts and affects ozone levels in the ground photochemical smog. But those vehicles need to be plugged into a cleanly powered smart grid, and we need to move towards the clean grid, the cleanly powered smart grid. And we can move today rapidly towards a smart grid with technologies that optimize use, and then healthy cities programs with green buildings, rooftop gardens, tree-lined streets, biking lanes, open space, permeable surface, smart growth, public transport, and cities connected by light rail. These can all make our cities healthier, create jobs, stimulate the economy, and help move us and move climate-friendly technologies into the global marketplace.
Dr. Paul Epstein, I want to thank you for being with us, Associate Director of the Center for Health on the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He is co-author of the forthcoming book, Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Riders on the storm, riders on the storm, into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, an actor out alone, riders on the storm, there's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday. Let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet mama.
Riders on the Storm. By the Doors here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The renowned Indian physician and human rights activist, Dr. Binayak Sen, has been sentenced to life in prison. On Friday, Dr. Sen and two others were convicted in court in India on charges of sedition and conspiracy. Described as India's most famous political prisoner, Dr. Sen is known as the physician of the poor. He has spent many years working as a doctor in the rural tribal areas of Chhattisgarh in central India and reported on unlawful killings of indigenous people by the police and private militias. The region is the site of intensifying conflict between India's central government and the Maoist Naxalites. In May of 2007, Dr. Sen was charged under the Draconian Unlawful Activities Prevention Act and the Chhattisgarh Special Public Safety Act. The allegations against him range from helping the Maoist insurgency, being a member of the terrorist organization, to waging war against the Indian state. In a statement released after his conviction, Amnesty International called Dr. Sen a prisoner of conscience. Asia-Pacific Director Sam Zarifi said, quote, "This sentence will seriously intimidate other human rights defenders who would provide a peaceful outlet for the people's grievances. Amnesty International believes that the charges against Dr. Sen are baseless and politically motivated," the statement said. Immediately after the sentencing Friday, Dr. Sen was taken back into custody. He had been free on bail since May of 2009. Earlier this year, Democracy Now!'s Anjali Kamat had a chance to speak with Dr. Sen by telephone while he was out on bail.
I was incarcerated for reasons that had—that were not personal. And the reason why there was an international campaign for my release was because there was—because I was incarcerated in a public cause. That was the general perception. And certainly no criminal acts have been even alleged against me so far. Whatever acts I have been, charged with are basically political in nature. So I take it as given that my incarceration had a political basis. And as a political case, I cannot have an individual freedom, and there is enormous amount of oppression, expropriation taking place across the country, with which we are still engaging, and also large numbers of people are in jail for reasons that we believe have very little to do with any acts that they might have performed. So till such events continue and until such events are granted the justice they deserve, I cannot count myself as being free.
Do you believe the situation in India has gotten better or worse since your release in terms of respecting people's rights to struggle for more sustainable development?
Without doubt, the situation has got worse since my release, and it is continuing to get to worsen. One is that there has now been a fairly open campaign against human rights workers and civil society workers of every description. The military campaign in the areas, in some areas of the country, has been stepped up, and the degree of violence has increased. And not only that, we also believe that the structural violence and the kind of poverty and dispossession that characterizes the poorest sections of the population, those phenomena have also got worse. So all in all, a pretty bleak scenario.
And can you comment on this law, the UAPA anti-terror law, that's being used to intimidate journalists and intellectuals into silence, people who try and talk to Maoists?
It's not only people who try and talk to Maoists, but as you said, the civil society activists in general are being targeted by the UAPA, which basically tries to establish guilt by association. And people arrested under the UAPA know, in general, one remarks that there is no cogent, credible evidence brought against them. The acts like the UAPA have been opposed in the past. Acts like the UAPA have been taken back in the past. We should also note that the acts like the UAPA are not only being deployed in India, because this is a much more general, worldwide phenomenon that is occurring under the guise of the war against terror, and we strongly oppose the deployment of such laws.
Dr. Sen, earlier this year there was a lot of fanfare about the fact that there's so many billionaires in India who had made it to the Forbes list of billionaires. Can you talk about the other India, what poverty and hunger look like over 60 years after independence?
33% of the adult population of India have a body mass index below 18.5, which signifies chronic undernutrition. 45% of the children in India are malnourished by weight for age criteria. Simply on the basis of anthropometric figures, we find that there is chronic hunger at work in the land. If we disaggregate this figure of 33% of the adult population, we find that among those social categories who are held to be poorer, that is, for instance, the scheduled castes and scheduled tribes, 60% of the scheduled castes have a body mass index below 18.5. And 50% of the scheduled tribes have a body mass index below 18.5. Now, these proportions bring the situation under the ambit of the WHO definition of a major public health emergency. In other words, we're talking about a famine here that is a stray in the land, and we are extremely apprehensive about the future of these sections of the population, who are also the ones who are being targeted in a massive drive for displacement and dispossession. These sections of the population are able to survive only because they have access to common property resources, and when they are displaced and dispossessed from the access to common property resources, their situation worsens immediately. And we are very extremely apprehensive about the future health of these communities of malnourished people. you started your question by talking about the Forbes billionaires. I think this is a mark of national shame that there are people starving in this country and that the number of billionaires are going up. It's nothing to be proud of. We are ashamed of it. Inequity is increasing all around.
Dr. Sen, can you comment on the use of violence by both the Maoists and the state?
Violence solves nothing. We have opposed the use of violence, deployment of violence, the conscious deployment of violence, planned deployment of violence, both by the state and by those who are opposing the state, like the Maoists. We have appealed for peace, and we believe that it's only through engagement in a political dialogue that any kind of resolution can occur. But the peace that we are asking for is not simply a cessation of violence. It also must encompass justice and equity as essential elements that need to be addressed before we can talk. We can think that peace has replaced violence. So we want peace, and we want just a peace that includes justice and equity for those who are suffering in this situation.
And finally, Dr. Sen, we're speaking to you from the United States. Can you comment on what you think the role of people in the United States can be in terms of bringing light to these sorts of human rights violations in India, both from the people of the United States, but also how do you think the government of the United States is playing a role in relation to India's development?
Well, to begin with, I think that inequity is not restricted to India. Severe degrees of inequity characterize the scene in United States as well. And I think that the United States, the people of the United States should pay, as they, I'm sure they are doing already, they should pay serious attention to the reduction of inequity in their own economy and in their polity and in their society. The second thing is that the state has a dual role. We see it as having a dual role in the present situation. One is as as the agency responsible for bringing about inequity and for providing certain services across the country, but also as the guarantor of expropriation and of oppression in all kinds of situations. And which of these two aspects is to prevail is something that the people of every country have to decide for themselves through active engagement with these political issues. And we also feel that these issues in any country, in any nation, these issues cannot be resolved within a particular framework. We need to have an international solidarity across the borders of nations, and we appeal to our brothers and sisters in the United States to engage with these issues just as we are engaging with them here in India, and so that we can build a peaceful and prosperous society together.
Dr. Binayak Sen, speaking to Democracy Now!'s Anjali Kamat in May. He has now been sentenced to life in prison. When we come back from break, we'll speak to his wife on the phone in India, talking about the sentencing of Dr. Sen on Friday. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Hey,
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined on the telephone right now by Alina Sen, Dr. Binayak Sen's wife, joining us from India. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the sentencing of your husband to life in prison last Friday?
Yes. Yes, Amy, it was a complete shock because we had not expected anything like this. We thought that since it was such a high-profile case and the state government of Chhattisgarh had staked their prestige on this, so we figured that they would find him guilty of something, although the evidence did not indicate any guilt. But we did not think that they would pin the charge of sedition onto him and sentence him to the maximum punishment for that, which is a life term. It was totally, totally unexpected. And I think both he and I, our daughters, and the rest of the family, and all his friends were in complete shock.
So he is now in prison, and you just saw him?
I saw him yesterday morning, and I want to tell you that he is confined in what is called a maximum security area of the prison, which is basically solitary confinement. It's a small courtyard with five cells, and he's in one of them. The two other co-accused in his case are in two of the other cells, and there are two other prisoners whom I don't know. So five cells are occupied, and they are let out into the courtyard only for about 4 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon, and that is it. And the rest of the time, they're locked away in the cell. He is not allowed access to newspapers, and the guy told me that some of the other prisoners in this high security area do get newspapers, but everything that is sensitive news is cut out with scissors, and any news relating to themselves or their cases or to the politics of India is cut out. So I imagine that Binayak has no idea that, all over the world people are talking about him and people have a lot of questions at the minimum and a lot of criticism at the maximum of the way in which he has been sentenced. But I don't think he knows any of this.
He has been, he as well as two others, have been convicted in court in India on charges of sedition and conspiracy. Can you respond to the conviction on these charges, on what they say he has done?
They say that he has couriered letters. It's a wild story that he has couriered letters from a Maoist prisoner in jail. And through this couriering, many of the acts of violence that the Maoists are perpetrating in different parts of India have come to pass. So in that sense, he forms part of the chain of conspiracy that has led to the Maoist violence. And it is all entirely based on circumstantial evidence. The law relating to sedition in India is an old one. It's a British law. And one of the earlier a famous person who was sentenced to sedition was Mahatma Gandhi. And the judge who sentenced him to imprisonment for 3 years and said that if the higher courts find that you are not guilty of sedition, I will be the happiest person. I'm just doing my duty. So that was the situation in British India. In independent India, the world's largest democracy, Binayak Sen, on very flimsy grounds and based entirely on circumstantial evidence, yes, he did visit the Maoist prisoner, but he did not courier letters. The evidence in court clearly brought out the fact that he could not have done it. All the meetings that he had with this person were supervised meetings. The jailers have testified that the meetings took place in their presence. There was no possibility that Binayak would courier letters. The unfortunate part of this conviction is that it is entirely based on the prosecution's allegations. The cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses that our lawyers have done have been ignored totally. And our defense witnesses who were put on and they testified to, for example, the fact that the house search was illegal and the documents that were seized at our house were carried away in an unsealed condition. None of these testimonies have been taken into account.
Can you talk about Dr. Binayak Sen, your husband's life work, how he has spent his years as a doctor?
When he graduated from medical college, he had the option to be anywhere in the world. And many of his colleagues, many of his classmates are, I believe, living in the United States and professionally well-renowned. Binayak chose to work in India and chose to work among tribals. For a short time after he graduated, he taught at Jawaharlal Nehru University, but he found that too esoteric. He wanted to work with people. So he moved to this part of central India and designed health programs at various levels with a trade union and later with tribal villagers, training health workers and teaching them to look after as much of their health needs as possible, setting up mobile laboratories in an area that was endemic to falciparum malaria, where malaria was a killer disease. So he spent all his life working with poor people on infectious diseases, not on esoteric medical conditions, and obviously did not make any money from his medical practice. He got involved with human rights work. He became a member of the PUCL, People's Union for Civil Liberties, during the emergency, but he was not a very active member until about 5 or 6 years ago, when the situation in Chhattisgarh became heavily polarized, and the Chhattisgarh government started something called the Sarvajurum, which was a vigilante movement, something that the state government was arming against the Maoists. But many of us felt that this was leading to large-scale human rights violations, and that there was a design in which the Sarvajurum would empty the villages out to take people to relief camps, refugee camps, and the lands where the Adivasi, where the tribals lived, were extremely rich lands, and they had different kinds of minerals under the soil, and this was just a ground-clearing operation.
I just wanted to read the words of the Nobel Prize-winning economist, Amartya Sen, who has spoken out for the release of your husband, Dr. Binayak Sen, noting his conviction on sedition charges is a ridiculous use of the laws, Amartya Sen said. He expressed hope the Supreme Court would give relief to the activist. He said he is outraged and upset and that this is a deep miscarriage of justice. Can the Supreme Court set aside this ruling?
I believe this, but the road to the Supreme Court is long because it has to go now to the State High Court before it can get to the Supreme Court. I do believe that the Indian legal system has the resilience to undo this kind of a violent, it's actually a violent travesty of justice.
Ilina Sen, we only have a few seconds. President Obama was just in India. Has the State Department weighed in? Have you been in touch with President Obama?
No, I have not, but I believe, I hope that our friends in the United States will, and I hope that people all over the world will bring pressure to bear upon the State Department of the United States, as well as upon the governments of their respective countries, to interact with the government of India, because the world is now a global village, and good governance is something that we all desire, all countries in the world, and there is no way that the government of India can allow this kind of a miscarriage of justice to go on.
Ilina Sen, we will leave it there, but we will follow the, of course, the progression of your husband's case. Dr. Binayak Sen has been sentenced to life in prison in India on sedition and conspiracy charges. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduceo, Armate, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.